I hope the Tate Ministry is doing this at this point, but I'm Sarah Naylor, and I'm an advocate for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and I work for the Lutheran Office, or I'm based at the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs in Washington, D.C. And the issues that I look at primarily are healthcare concerns, and then issues that that impact nonprofit organizations in this country. So, when I speak with you, I will be speaking with you from that perspective, from a perspective of advocacy, because I really believe in it. I'm really committed to the work of advocacy. And instead of doing it at the front end this time, I'll tell you what my perspective on advocacy is as we get into the session. But at the very beginning, I'd like to talk with you about healthcare concerns as they affect women and children, generally women and children in poverty, but not necessarily. And next week, I'll be talking about the issue of access to healthcare for everyone. But I felt that it was really important to spend some real intentional time talking about the issues that women and children encounter, because as you may or may not know, women and children in this country are the fastest growing, are the persons who find themselves on poverty most often. And so that is a major concern for us and for the work that we are about. Before we get started, could you each go around and tell me your name and where you're from? That's needing to humor me, because I won't remember, but it would be helpful for me to know that.
I'm Carol Quain, I'm from Tacoma, Washington.
Okay.
Janelle DeRucci from here, Thomas,
hi, Janelle.
Mike Morris from Wilmer, Minnesota.
John Osborne from Hamilton, Montana.
Linda Larson from Wilmer, Minnesota.
Minnesota?
Carol Gates from the Seattle area.
Okay.
Cameron Knowles from Seattle.
Holly Lucy from Wilmer, Minnesota.
Mildred Percy from Wilmer, Minnesota.
And I guess Braswell from Tacoma.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm glad you joined me this morning. Okay, I'd like to just share some facts with you and then have an opportunity for us to discuss what I've shared and also your input into the issue. I want to just tell you that as of this year, well, what I want to do is to spend the time talking primarily about Medicaid expansion, because Medicaid is a program of assistance in this country that provides probably one of the most opportunities for women and children to receive assistance. And it is a program whereby states are authorized to provide assistance, and it's based on income eligibility. And that is the rub. That is where we generally find that most people fall through the cracks. Because if you are at the lower end of the income scale, you have the greatest opportunity to access Medicaid. Those persons who fall between those income levels and who are able to care for themselves financially are the ones who fall through the cracks. So let's talk about this for a moment. On April 1st, 1990, a major expansion in Medicaid eligibility for pregnant women and young children took place. And this is a victory, because Medicaid levels, eligibility levels, were set very low. And because states have an opportunity to set those levels, we find a wide range of access to assistance. State Medicaid programs are now required, and that's a key word, to provide Medicaid coverage to all pregnant women, infants, and children under the age of 6 years. and a number of us fought for that, to make sure that children under six, well, we really wanted it to be, much more inclusive, but we were able to get 6 years that they would be covered up to that age. At any rate, these people are covered with family incomes below 133% of the federal poverty level. Now that 133% equates to, for a family of four, $16,884 a year. That is incredible. I mean, that's really good, even though $16,000 in many places doesn't buy you very much. That has been a real victory. Prior to this change, states were required to provide Medicaid coverage to pregnant women and infants with family incomes below 75% of the poverty level, or $9,522 a year for a family of four. However, states had the option to set income eligibility limits for pregnant women and infants as high as 185% of the poverty level. This change is most significant, and I want to talk about the states where it's most significant, because I've said to you that states have had the option of being able to set those limits up to 185%, but most did not. None have, I don't believe. The states where this is most significant is Colorado, Indiana, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Dakota, and Wisconsin, which chose to leave their eligibility limits at 75% of the poverty level. It is also significant for those states which provided coverage for pregnant women and infants with family incomes below 100% of the poverty level. Some states will not be affected by this change because they already set Medicaid income eligibility limits for pregnant women and infants above 133% of poverty. Now, I'll list those states to you also, because I think this is important. They are California, Connecticut, Florida, Hawaii, Iowa, Kansas, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, New York, North Carolina, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Vermont, Washington, and West Virginia. Some states have not yet raised their income eligibility limits for pregnant women and infants to 133% of the poverty level. Most of these states are awaiting action by their state legislatures to enact these new limits. And they anticipate that that will happen by July. But no state gets off the hook because it has been mandated. As of April 1, 1990, states are required to provide Medicaid coverage to all children under age 6 with family incomes below 133% of the federal poverty level. Until now, states had the option to provide Medicaid coverage to children under age 8 with family incomes up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Most states had raised the income eligibility limits for some children, but generally just for younger children. In most places, it was up to the age of 3 or under. So at any rate, this new legislative change represents a tremendous increase in the number of young children who are eligible for Medicaid coverage now, because the mandate increases the income limits in all states for all children under the age of 6. The impact of the change is particularly dramatic in states that never took the option to raise Medicaid eligibility limits for children. For example, in Alabama, this is the worst. In Alabama, the Medicaid income eligibility limit for children has increased from 14%, can you believe that, to 133% of poverty. So, my question for us to talk about primarily, I want to pass this around so that you can see this. This is the list, or the new Medicaid eligibility update that is in effect as of April, and it lists all the states and talks and shows you what the eligibility limits are based on income, based on a monthly income. So you get an idea of what that looks like. Do any of you have any questions about what I've presented to you so far? Or comments?
To provide the dollars for that health care, is that all federal money or a combination of federal and state money, especially to the states where it impacts greatly now in terms of increasing their budget to spend for Medicaid?
It's always been a combination of federal and state dollars. And that's the reason why many states did not want to increase those eligibility limits, because they didn't, because that's a hefty chunk, you know, coming out of the state coffers. So they resisted that. Meanwhile, many women and children went without health care. Anybody else?
I think one group that's overlooked a lot as far as women and children are the overlooked as far as our thinking about them anyway is the senior citizen woman who is no longer working and is alone.
Amen. I agree. You're right. Anybody else? We'll talk about that some more next week. Anybody else? Well, one of the issues that I want to discuss with you, or I would like us all to talk about, is an issue that many people debate. Whether or not programs that are discretionary programs provide human services for people should be administered at the federal level or at the state level. Whether our government should be more centralized when it comes to discretionary spending for programs of assistance. These are the programs that relate to health care only that are impacted by the discretionary budget, our national discretionary budget. All of these stand to be cut. If Graham Rudman, in fact, is enacted. But even apart from that, these are the healthcare programs that are always up for grabs in terms of our national budget. So I'm curious, you know, how do you all feel about who administers these programs? And do you have any thoughts about how it can better be done? Yeah.
Well, I don't like the idea of the federal government administering everything, but I don't know that in our country today we will ever have any fairness or justice if we don't let the federal government do it. And I think our federal government's priorities have been haywire. I mean, get rid of the B-2 and the stealth bomber and put it in maternal. I mean, to me, it just makes so much more sense. And I think the federal government is going to have to make some decisions now. I hope we don't keep fighting a Cold War that doesn't exist by putting in enormous funds in military budgets. But those of us in Washington know that people don't want to lose their jobs in the great military. And the people programs in the military don't bother me. It's the weaponry that bothers me. Mm-hmm. And I think we have the money in the United States of America if we choose our priorities correctly. And I don't think the states by themselves will be able to handle the massiveness of these kind of programs.
How do you all feel about what she said, which her comments?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of truth to that. I think it does have to be, to some degree, a shared responsibility. And of course, if you let the federal government in, you are sort of opening a can of worms. But economically, some of the states that need this kind of discretionary funding the most is some of the ones that have the smallest tax base because they have such a high number of unemployed. Alabama is a state you mentioned. And I would suspect that their tax base is a lot lower because the incomes of the people are a lot lower. So without assistance from the federal government, they wouldn't be able to meet their own state's needs as well. Whereas you have a more affluent state like California that is probably doing a bang-up job, but then there's an inequity there. Mm-hmm.
When you say the federal government, were you going to say something, Jody?
I'm wondering whether there's a choice C, whether the only choices we've got in this quiz are between federal government and state government. Mm-hmm. How about if we could push it down at least, what if the federal government would set some standards for us, make sure that there's some equity. My own experience with state governments tells me that they are often the most reactionary governmental bodies in the earth to deal with, right? So I don't have a whole lot of faith at the state level, but I sure do have a lot of faith at the community level. And it seems to me an awful lot of this stuff can be gotten to people more effectively if a lot of the control is at the community level. In a whole lot of states that I'm acquainted with, the folks who need these services most don't have very much clout at the state level, but they really do have some clout at the local level. So I want to just sort of push for a choice C here, mm-hmm. federal, state, and some local control.
Great. Yes.
It bothers me that sometimes we talk about federal government as though they have so much money and they can do anything. They are us. We're the ones that give them their money. I mean, that's where it comes from. And so it seems like we need to have a say in it. I like this idea of doing it at the community, but I think that's something in our thinking. It's just not this bunch of money that's out there. I mean, we feel so wonderful if we get some money from the federal government. Well, it's usually getting back what we've already given them.
That's what taxes are about.
Yeah.
Greatest recycling program there is. I think there's a fundamental issue in all as we consider this kind of question. That I was at a conference in April in Chicago, and there was a sister there from Washington, D.C., who talked about the budget. I mean, this would be a federal, state, local level as being an expression of value. And I wonder, you know, whether we really, is there a way to really get hold of that as the people, as the citizens, and to communicate that to our legislators that we want budgets to reflect values, not promises, not pork barrel, not a lot of other stuff, but the values of a country that's concerned for women and children, that's concerned for its older adult, that, you know, whatever. And how do we get that kind of national debate going? It's going, but how do we increase it? That's rhetorical.
Sure.
But I think it's a real issue. In Washington, and you may have shared this earlier before I got here, there's a citizens budget campaign that is looking at the budget in far different terms than traditional terms. There's the Black Caucus budget that does some of the same kinds of things. Yet our people in churches don't know about these. You know, how do we get that kind of word out so that when you're right, you can say, you know, I've looked at the proposal of the Citizens Budget Campaign, and I like what I see because it expresses my values as a part of this country.
Or the Congressional Black Caucus budget.
Either one.
Is far incredible. Superior to what we've got. Yes.
Well, that kind of links to what he's saying to a degree that I see, you know, I think the local level probably would confront it more powerfully or have more of an impact perhaps, but the biggest need seems to be that the people who are educated know how to get the funding, and sometimes they don't even need them as desperately, and those who have not been given the education to find out where the resources are suffering. I noticed that a lot with You know, I mean, even like with Medicaid, some elderly people aren't sure about the forms and they could get more money back.
Absolutely.
So I think however we do it, we need to really simplify it because it's unfair to have things in terms that aren't easily understandable for everyone. So
absolutely.
I don't know which agency can do that most effectively.
Us. I mean, we really have to be the ones to advocate for a simplification
mm-hmm.
of the system
mm-hmm.
because, you know, that whole process of application is a screening out process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't meant to screen people in, it's meant to screen people out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you're absolutely right. And I think that until we, all of us as citizens in this country, really across the board express our concern about this, more than concern, that we begin to talk about what it is we want in very real terms, I think we'll continue to have what we've got. And that's too bad. Yes.
I think it's frightening when you think of the savings and loan scandal right now and the billions of dollars that we as taxpayers are going to end up paying for a few people getting rich quick. And yet I have a feeling somehow the Congress is going to come up with money somewhere to do something about that.
You betcha.
And, you know, I think we need to elect new officials, but it is so hard for common people with what I think the values we need in government to be elected because they don't have the money. It's an enormously expensive thing to run for government these days. We have a young man in our church running now on a shoestring against Norm Dix, who, you know, Norm Dix has $900,000 in his campaign chest. I mean, it's David and Goliath, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we change so that we get the priorities we want? How do we elect people?
See, I understand the reality. I think sometimes, you know, this may reflect a bit of a naive attitude some people may think. But I really do believe that if we were to really get behind a candidate who represents the people, a populist kind of position, if we were able to do that across the board and support that person who's running on the shoestring, that would say some things, you know? And it would really say that this person may have the money and may be able to launch this incredibly visible campaign. But that person can't be visible if the people aren't behind him or her. And I think that it's going to really call for a number of people who really have a different view to be able to educate those who would make the choice based on what they've always done. You know, to be able to help people understand that there are options and that we have them. Yes, Jody.
I'd be interested, Sarah, in your read from Washington on it looks sometimes from the heartland of the country like there's a major change in the mood about health care as a priority in any way,
mm-hmm.
at any rate. And it's one sees it reflected in, for instance, a number of major business people talking about national health insurance for the first time. Better not climb over that.
Excuse me.
So you got a little acrobat over
here. Yeah.
So that you've got Lee Iacocca, you know, saying, look, we make cars here, but the largest chunk of money that we spend to make our cars is on health care insurance.
Absolutely.
This doesn't make any sense. We can't compete with the Japanese if we're paying for health care mostly rather than the metal that goes into the cars. Right? So that as more and more people are thinking that way about priorities, there's some real sort of self-interest in the power centers in
absolutely.
The country that begins to, it seems to me, to shift the the politics around this a little bit, and it allows candidates, even mainstream candidates, to be talking about national health insurance or some other kind of national health commitment in a way that they haven't done before. At least that's the way it seems from where I sit. Yeah. I don't know whether you see it in Washington that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to talk about that next week primarily when we talk about universal access to health care, which is my bias, and the work that I've been involved in with a number of different denominations. All the denominations that have representation in Washington have been talking about this issue. And we're doing more than talking about it now. We're really developing a campaign that is going to be moving across the country. And there are a number of different entities that are involved in the same discussion and development of campaign. But I've been involved in co-chairing the group that is the interreligious voice on the issue. And I'm real excited about what we're coming up with. And the primary agenda item is to place this issue on the presidential campaign. Well, place it on their agenda as it comes up. So that's going to be exciting, and I'll talk with you more about that next week. One of the things that I want to do is to talk about, I guess, not only the healthcare issues, but issues like WIC and like Head Start and my list here that's got all of these different discretionary programs on it. I'm really interested in what you're saying, your option C, as well as the state and federal option, because I just have my own vision of it. And what you all are saying is really helpful to me in terms of what's really best in these situations. From where I sit, I look at it and see that the people who are generally at the upper end of the income scale, I think I said this a couple of days ago, people who are generally at the upper end of the income scale are those persons who really want to see decentralized government, you know, really want to see these programs administered in different kinds of ways, not even block grant, but to give the money to the people directly so that they can begin to make their own decisions, and somehow that's empowering people. I have some major concerns about that. Persons who are at the lower end of the income scale generally would be concerned and would want there to be standards that are set, as you're saying, at the national level, so that we can do things like developing WIC as an entitlement program instead of a program that is just funded from year to year and you have to fight for the money for it. If you develop it as an entitlement program, it has a longer life. And then what you're doing is reauthorizing that program at the end of, a 5-year period or a 4-year period of its entitlement life. So what happens then is that you guarantee that people are going to receive at least a basic level of care. That happens to be my bias, but you know, it may be that I am, you know, looking at this from my perspective and not seeing it as you all would see it. So that's the reason I bring that up. I really am concerned about that.
I have a number of reflections I'd like to make as a rural family physician. I work in a small town in central Minnesota. The issues are great, and many changes are going to need to take place, will take place in the next 25 years in all of healthcare, I'm sure. But when we talk about providing healthcare to low-income families and women and children, I think primarily we need to reflect on the fact that as a society, there has been a significant switch in internal values for healthcare in the last 50 years. Without realizing it, I think most of us truly accept the fact that right now access to healthcare should be a right. course you should have that, and everyone should have the best, and we should have it today or yesterday. That's what I think we feel, especially if we're thinking of our children or our parents as they age. That's new. In most Western societies, healthcare has been a privilege, you know, something that was bought and paid for, and only the wealthy could afford, and the non-wealthy just didn't have it. I think that's a good change, to my personal bias from a Christian perspective. That's fine. As a society, I don't think we fully realize the impact that that basic change in value structure has now and is going to have. We believe it, but no one yet is. And lack of focusing on that issue, I think, is bringing up most of these problems of inequity of income. But it's also creating a problem in our own state of access to health care. We have fairly generous eligibility requirements for Medicaid, for example, in Minnesota. But we're having more and more problems with people not willing or able to serve Medicaid patients. You read about that in Time and Newsweek about big city hospitals tripping the Medicaid from one hospital to another, till they finally land a county general and wait, what are we talking about, 3 or 4 days on a gurney in the hallway before they're seen.
Absolutely.
And fortunately, it hasn't come to that in Minnesota. And yet, they're in our own county. There right now are 4 clinics that have gone on public record within the last 15 months of saying, I'm sorry, we're no longer serving Medicaid patients.
Yeah.
There are inequities in the payment schedules, and states decide them, but they're very different. In Minnesota, the payment to a physician's clinic, to my primary care clinic, actually per patient visit, we not only give away the services, but we pay out in terms of overhead. Every time I see a Medicaid patient, I lose money.
Absolutely.
If I see too many in my practice, as much as I may wish to, I have to let employees go, or decrease the quality of care, or have everyone wait longer for tests, whatever. So it's not only a donation, it costs us money to provide those services right now. And clinics that are overburdened with an extraordinary amount of percentage of their patients that are Medicaid simply say we can't do it. Because if you don't do something about this, not only can't provide the Medicaid patients, but you won't even have a doctor or clinic in your town. It'll be closed. It'll go somewhere else. So that's one problem. And inequity around the country is another problem. The most immediate example to me is our influx of large Hispanic population in our town of 18,000 in the last 2 years, and 2,000 new residents are all American Texan Hispanics. When the oil glut took place and unemployment was very high in Texas, some of our former very stable migrant population of agricultural workers started staying, and they have migrant council funds, which is an excellent program, the migrant health program. But then when they become residents, they go off migrant health, but virtually all will qualify in Minnesota for Medicaid, which is fine. The next year, I had cases in my own practice that this would happen. They got such good health care and had a baby or two, and next year brought grandma up to Minnesota because she's needed her gallbladder for 5 years and can't get it done there, but come to Minnesota and live there 2 weeks and you can have your gallbladder out. Well, this is inequitable also. It's okay for grandma to get her gallbladder out, but it doesn't seem fair to me that Minnesota clinics are going out of business providing the care of trying to, while in Texas they're not taking care of the responsibility. I only pointed out as one of the inequities. For that reason, as Jody mentioned, I think that my personal belief, if I reflected over 4 years of med school and 3 years of specialty training and 6 years now in practice, is that what we may end up with is a centrally mandated basic level of health care for all citizens, whether they're employed, unemployed, poverty level, rich or poor. Everyone gets the same, your basic care package of health care. That may not include a CAT scan the second week you've had a bad headache.
Absolutely.
Okay. It may not include 5 ultrasounds during your pregnancy, but it will ensure that you're okay. And for people that want the Cadillac, right now you see Medicare does provide Cadillac. Medicaid provides better health care than I can purchase through insurance for my own family. Better health care, quicker, any specialist you want, the day you want it, and you're not allowed to refuse. That's the way the program is set up now. In our state.
Yes.
You know, no copays. If you come to the doctor,
that's real important to say.
You know, with a runny nose at 2 a.m, get the physician out of bed to come see you, that's fine. The physician still gets $11 for that hour of work. You know. But So I would suggest, or I'm proposing, that my goal would be to see a centrally core basic package of health care guaranteed to every citizen, and including a small copay. It may only be $2, $5, a pack of cigarettes, whatever, some sort of copay that helps you be responsible about your own personal use of the system. And then an augmented system, as Scandinavia and Great Britain and Germany now have, where if you wish to have something quicker, better, faster, or more high-tech above the basic package, that's fine if you can afford it, or if you can afford the private insurance to have it. In other words, it's all available if you want to take responsibility for paying for it. But if you don't wish to take responsibility or can't afford to take responsibility, fine, you still will have basic health guaranteed and provided, and won't, you know, and will have providers available.
I am
I don't have the answers, but I know that those are specific problems we deal with every day.
I'm so glad to hear a physician say what you've said, because the common misconception, well, not common misconception, many physicians don't have your perspective. However, I've been hearing that the American Medical Association is beginning to move toward a change in their perspective on the issue of universal access. And that's exciting. I mean, a number of places are, just because of the cost. And because, I think that's what's mainly driving the debate, is the issue of cost. And we'll talk more about that. But I agree with you very much. Right now in Congress, or at least that I'm aware of, in D.C., there are 9 proposals on the table relating to a national health care program of some sort. And they vary from being the Cadillac to providing a very basic program. And the issue in all of them is who's going to pay for it. But that's exciting to me, because it says that at least we're going to get there. And I believe that in this next presidential election, that's going to really be a hot potato. It really is. And that's great. Did you have a question or a comment? I really appreciate your contribution. It was really good. Yes.
Well, I think it's really important for everybody to get, you know, fair medical information. And I know in Norway what the system is, and I know one of the problems is the long wait. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that would be a contribution for assistance. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that cause that. But one of the concerns I have would be for the medical profession right now bearing a real heavy burden with the influx of more diseases and more things coming on, that they're getting a real heavy load as far as some of the things that are coming on. And I think that we need to provide the care. And I wonder what we're doing to facilitate some of their needs so that they don't just feel so overburdened and we get so much burnout. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can foresee some of those problems. And
well, it does happen. In the inner city, the inner city is one of those places, and in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Both of those places really experience tremendous inequities in the ability to be able to provide the kind of care that's necessary. In the inner city, there are many hospitals. You've heard about it, I'm sure. Many hospitals that have closed down. At least their emergency rooms have closed down because they aren't able to provide the care. It's unbelievable to me. I just pray as I go through Washington, D.C., that I don't have an accident or anything that requires immediate attention. I pray that prayer every day. truly, because I do not want to end up in one of those places where I have need for immediate access to care. You know, if we can schedule it, that may be somewhat better. But it's frightening.
Educating the population more and more on just basic safety and taking care of themselves, I suppose.
Yeah, but the thing that's most frightening is the fact that people are... The system of care is overburdened. It's overtaxed. It's out of control, you know, and there are a number of reasons for that. You know better than I do. And then Ed and I used to live in Arizona, where we would talk with people in rural areas about having care and all kinds of other programs administered, and it's just as difficult. Maybe even more so, I don't know, for people to access health care in rural areas than it would be even in the inner city. But I don't know. I just think it's really, it's frightening. And we have to do something.
It's interesting. I don't know if any other areas are hitting this through Washington, D.C. The Whitman Walker Clinic, which is really a well-known AIDS program, is facing the potential of having to close its doors because of the high cost of health care for their staff. I mean, these folks are in risky situations, and the premiums are going sky high, you know, well over $1,000 a month for employees coverage. So much so that DC government is considering, or was, they decided no one, at least in the city council, a special subsidy to this clinic to help pay their premiums for coverage for their employees. The other interesting piece that may also be a part of this driving is the what's happening in church health care plans. Several major denominations are facing a real crisis in terms of the escalating cost of providing health coverage and dental coverage for those who are enrolled from the church's ranks.
I just attended a meeting last week that was conducted by a coalition called Church Alliance, where they bring together all of the various board of pensions from the various denominations together to talk about their pension and benefits programs. The primary reason we came together, and I'm not a part of that, but I was representing the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in that discussion. The primary reason we were coming together was to talk about the issue of healthcare, you know, and the provision. How do you pay for the premiums and what kind of plans are you going to offer and all of that? There were three denominations who had programs, plans that had gone belly up in the last year. So they are not able to provide coverage for their church employees. We're talking about providing care for church people who are working for various denominations. And every single one of them, including the ELCA, was really concerned because in the next year, costs are going to go up between 12% and 15% to pay for premiums. So we're going to, you know, we're going to really see some real shifting, some real... One of the conclusions they came to was that they're going to have further conversation around the issue of developing a single plan that would serve all of the various denominations. So they would consolidate into one plan and be a single provider, develop a single provider system.
Is there any way, this might be a naive question, question when you're dealing with lawyers and insurance companies and so on, but is there any way to control the amount of settlements or payments that are made that cause these high premiums? I just think of if a physician didn't have to pay, and you said you're losing money in certain cases, if you didn't have to pay a high cost of premiums because some lawyer is going for malpractice and is making a lot of money on malpractice suits that are they're going for the juggler in many of these cases to have some kind of a ceiling on certain types of cases. I think of some surgery that I had done about 2 or 3 years ago. Had the same surgery two months apart. And I saw the doctor's bill was jacked up considerably the second time, and I said, well, my insurance paid only a certain amount this first time. And the receptionist said, oh, don't worry about that. We're gonna see how much money we can get this next time, but you don't have to worry about making up the difference. That's not fair.
Right.
And I just, what can be done about that type of thing? Because I think, we've just been talking about insurance premiums, that affects the whole program.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It has to be fleshing on some of those areas as well, I guess, the take them a couple at a time. There has been some significant tort reform. Tort is the branch of law that has to do with suing people. Tort reform for medical malpractice at various state levels. In Minnesota, we had several victories the year before last. They put ceilings on the limit of damage awards for medical malpractice. And also required, it gets rather technical, but had some specific requirements that had to be met prior to a suit being able to be brought to put down in what you would call frivolous suits. And that has helped, and that's beginning to happen around the state. I'd say that the malpractice crisis is not yet over, but it has begun to ease. And fortunately, the three major malpractice insurance carriers in the country have all dropped their rates slightly in the last 2 years.
And
so that is good.
And can I add something to that? At the national level, there is also discussion of legislation that would deal with malpractice and set standards across the board for the country. But, you know, you can understand the tension there.
Yeah, there's certainly with more lawyers and physicians making the laws of the land.
Absolutely.
It's a challenging area to make progress in. So that's one area. I don't think, although my person is a family physician who does assistant surgery and delivers babies, my malpractice rate myself is about $11,000 a year. Of that, over $3,000 is just the portion for doing obstetrics and delivering babies. And at the, you know, if you look at the collection, what insurance companies will pay, you know, you never pay a full charge, you pay a percentage of that, and what it costs to provide the care. Basically, of the 40 babies or so I deliver a year, the first 18 I do to pay the malpractice. And then the next is where I can start paying my health, and maybe the last 8 or 9 is where I can generate my income. You put it in those terms. So it's still very expensive to have malpractice insurance.
Absolutely.
So that's just that one particular area. Why are the rates going up? You know, it's not all doctor's fees, but it's in large measure doctor's fees, and the area that needs the most reform and is being reformed in Medicare is what we call surgical specialties. Mm-hmm. People who do things, cut, snip, sew, compared to doctors who think, or psychiatrists who visit and talk, or family doctors who will explain to you about smoking and blood pressure and how they're connected, are being reimbursed very poorly. But to replace a cataract, which takes an eye doctor approximately 25 to 45 minutes, you reimburse several thousand dollars. Mm-hmm. To put in a total hip replacement for grandma with bad arthritis, again, is $5,000 to $6,000 paid by the government. The payment there is extremely high. The other area that generates tremendous cost is the technical aspects of healthcare.
Can I interrupt you one
yeah.
second? Last year, a piece of legislation that passed was physician payment reform. Is that?
I was going to mention
that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. RVRVS is important, I think. It only covers Medicare so far.
Exactly.
But anyway, high-tech medicine is very expensive. It took us a long time to get used to ordering. When I was in medical school, you had to think long, very long and hard about ordering a CAT scan, a special type of x-ray. Now, because of malpractice worries and because of the help it does give in diagnosing, you think people are, you know, ordering CAT scans just right and left without a second thought, and now we're supposed to give a little thought before ordering the next high-tech test called magnetic resonance imaging. MRI test is like the super CAT scan. And CAT scans are $300 a crack, MRIs are $700 a crack.
In California, okay. They're
$12 to $17 to $2,000
a crack.
And I see it as a problem because the reason it's so expensive is this equipment is expensive, and the equipment's expensive because the companies that make it charge a lot. They're paying for their research and development or R&D to make it. The bottom line is if it's not profitable for them to make it, it's a free enterprise system, they won't make it. They took IUDs off the market not because they weren't a good birth control device for some women, but because they weren't in business to get sued. They were in business to make money. And although there's been no proof that IUDs truly caused some of the problems that they were alleged to have caused, they felt they couldn't sit around and be sued forever, so they better just take it off the market. These types of things. So high-tech medicine is the second thing I think that really drives up the cost of healthcare. The third thing I truly believe, from my own family's perspective, as well as patients and society, is that we all seem to have, right now, an insatiable appetite for healthcare. But we like our healthcare, we like a good doctor, and we like having that extra test that helps us know for sure that things are okay. That's much better today than waiting a month to see if my problem is still around.
Right.
You know, and unfortunately, physicians, because of malpractice, are oftentimes driven to go ahead and order that confirming test that it costs them $700, rather than saying, as they might have said in their grandparents' time, let's wait and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do we do about that? Again, I just have one comment. I think Holden stresses grassroots efforts. What are some things we each can do that can collectively help to hold the healthcare costs down? Number one is you don't run to the doctor for every tiny little thing. Number two is make sure that the plan that you purchase is not the streamlined Cadillac HMO first dollar coverage. That costs all of us a fortune. Okay, you can go into the doctor and you can get your prescription for $2 and you can do this and do that, and it's almost free. We all love it. I mean, no one isn't going to pick out a candy bar if someone tells us it's free. Pick out anything at the candy counter you want, it's free. We're all going to grab the biggest, juiciest, most chocolatey thing we can find. Human nature. Same with healthcare. When it's free, or we perceive it's free because someone out there is paying for it, we want it all, and we want it yesterday. The healthcare plan I've chosen for my own family that I provide for my employees is, you know, it's an 80-20 catastrophic coverage, and we have to pay a $500 deductible, and that insurance costs us less money. You know, that seems expensive for employees, so we're fine. We toss in the $500 free on the front end. I mean, there's things you can do individually to make it affordable. But think about it as you purchase insurance for your family, that you don't need the Cadillac model, you don't have to go to the doctor for anything, and healthcare costs will begin to come down.
I think there's something else we can do to add to your list, is look at the issue of prevention. You know, so that if we begin a healthy lifestyle, if we begin at the front end, I happen to have an HMO, or belong to one. I love it because one of the things that's stressed there is prevention and education. And you don't get the same doctor all the time, and you don't get the Cadillac of services all the time, but it allows me to be able to keep a better, well, to be more proactive on my own behalf.
I think this whole thing of education is so important, and I think it brings it home right here at Holden. Of you're not here 2 days when you hear a number of people complaining about the food. I mean, Holden has good, nutritious food.
Yes.
But for people who aren't used to it, you know, I have, and we've been coming here 14 years, and every year somebody complains about the food that we have. So I think, you know, that's the kind of education we need, that
yes.
Nutritious food is helpful.
Absolutely.
You know, to young mothers, to anybody.
Yes.
I don't know how to do that exactly, but I think we need to do that. Educate people.
Pamela, you were going to make a comment.
I was just going to reiterate, I think that the physician said it just fine, but when we were talking about, you know, insurance, and you went back to your doctor and they said the second time,
we're going to bump up the price and see if we get a little more. I'm an emergency room department nurse, and in my spare time I do what doctors love most, utilization review for insurance companies. And I think he's quite right in saying that the doctors who think don't get paid for that time, whereas the doctors who cut do. There was a large article a number of weeks ago, months ago, in the Wall Street Journal. It covered a good portion of the front page and extended well into the back about fraudulent practices in insurance. And it's become kind of a catch-22 between, well, we can justify this unethical behavior to, because we're getting these really high insurance costs and Medicare's not paying enough. But it's, there's a lot of duplicity, and unfortunately it is among the surgical folks, where they'll reword the same operation three different ways and charge three different prices. They only did it once. This is a serious problem in adding to this whole thing of healthcare costs. There was a wonderful editorial in a medical journal called Postgraduate Medicine that does reflect that doctors are taking a hard look at that, and it was, don't worry about it, your insurance pays for it. And the editor, who is a physician, had taken his car in and had gotten just a little ding in a fender bender and had to have the frame around his headlight fixed. And he said it was, you know, maybe $25 and 10 minutes in time. They replaced the whole front quarter panel in the headlight, and it was $500. And he said, well, that's silly. That didn't need to have to happen. And the mechanic said, don't worry about it. Your insurance covers it. And he said he remembered how many times had he said that to patients about ordering a just one more test to kind of be sure. And don't worry, your insurance covers it. And we in healthcare do sometimes do that. And we make our decisions about how we care for people, of what kind of insurance do they have. They've got Blue Cross, no sweat, they'll cover this, we'll do this test. And we really do have to, in healthcare, take some responsibility too, not only in monitoring our own behavior, but in helping people learn what is and isn't appropriate. In the emergency department, we become very frustrated sometimes with people who come in and wave their welfare coupon like it's an American Express gold card and say, I have coupons, and I've had this cold for 3 weeks. Well, in healthcare, that's not defined as an emergency. However, in many states, this woman couldn't go to a clinic because there are not clinics available, because they're not taking Medicare, Medicaid, or Medicare, Medicaid may not cover that problem in a clinic. But if they come to the emergency room, it's covered. So there's a whole host of educational things we have to do at the governmental level, at the grassroots level, and at the professional level as healthcare providers. That's not an answer. It just adds to the confusion, I guess.
I reminded of just some of the reading I'd done last week on the way to Holden, and this week in the surprising gift book that Lutzen wrote about Holden, and the quote that Carol Hinderly, the first director, had about in Holden. We don't really answer many questions, but we at least try and frame the proper questions.
On that note. You know. Thank you all for coming. This has been a very stimulating discussion, and I appreciate the contribution that all of you have made. And we'll talk about it some more next week. Which time I want to talk more about what happens with providers and reimbursement issues and that sort of thing. So thank you very much.